Ever wish you had a roadmap for your money and your legacy that actually makes sense? You're in the right place. Welcome to Money Sense, where I have spent over 35 years helping people plan, not just for their finances, but for their whole life.
Welcome to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. And today we are joined by Eric Fabian from Haight & Fabian Law. Welcome to the podcast, Eric.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Before we jump in, Eric, I'm going to just introduce you a little bit and talk about our topic today, which is legacy planning and conversations that people should be having with their family, with spouses, with kids, and why that matters so much. So, Eric, you join EING with a great deal of experience, background in estate planning. You went to Madison.
That I did for 7.5 years.
Yep. And got your law degree and also have a degree in real estate.
Yeah. Finance and real estate, a double majored in undergrad.
Awesome. You're a phone a friend if I ever need to call someone. And I've known you now for going on 7 years since I joined EIG as a wealth advisor, and you've helped so many of our clients out with their estate plans over the years. So we thank you for your knowledge and what you have been providing to them.
Very much appreciate and enjoy working with all of you.
Why don't we kind of jump into our topic a little bit today, which is something that people don't really like to think about very much.
True.
Which involves the idea of planning for your end of life. Final planning, final wishes. Let's see. People, we talk about it all the time in our meetings. It's not something we lead with, but inherently it comes up. And really the idea is making sure that people have put some thought into crafting a plan that involves their family members and helps them achieve their ultimate goals, which is to have, you know, their end of life planning covered. So what are some initial thoughts on the topic, Eric? Do you have anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that nobody ever really wants to talk about or think about. And so you typically find that people put it off. And then when they finally come in to meet with me, whether it's even a younger person or an older person, more often than not, they'll say at the end of it, I'm really happy. I feel so much better that I got it done. They don't want to talk about it when we first get into the meeting, but they feel much more relief after we've got everything planned because they know it'll make things easier, not only when they pass, but also estate planning is what happens if you're incapacitated. And yep. So a lot of times, you know, when you put things in that perspective, you know, people will say to you, oh, what do I care? I'm not around anymore. Well, you could be around. It could be that you're incapacitated. You need somebody to take over handling your affairs. And so it's just a really important conversation to have with somebody early on.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember being here for a short time when I joined EIG, and in one of my first meetings with one of my colleagues here, we met with a woman who had two adult daughters that just lost their dad. Like within a matter of a month of that meeting that I'm sitting across the table with this woman, she had lost her husband unexpectedly in an accident in which no one saw that coming. So, you know, fortunately, I mean, I guess very, very sad for the family, but fortunately they did plan for that through things that we're going to discuss today. So why don't we begin with just kind of the lay of the land, talk about some of the basic estate planning documents that people might want to think about. And before you jump in, I'm just going to say in our first financial planning meetings with our clients, whether, you know, they're brand new to EIG or we've been with them for a long time, we're either going to review their estate plan or we're going to implement their estate plan. It's a core thing. So talk a little bit about that first meeting where we, you know, bring you in and types of things that come up.
Yep. So I always tell people that I'm going to ask you all kinds of personal questions because I need to understand exactly what you have going on, what your family dynamics look like, what your assets look like, the type of assets people are holding. All that goes into how to properly build an estate plan. And, you know, people say, well, I'm young. I don't need an estate plan. That's not true. You still want to have something in place. And, you know, people will say, well, I'm not overly wealthy. Well, that doesn't matter either. We still are trying to put protections in place. Oftentimes, we're trying to avoid the public aspect of probating an mm-hmm. estate or making things time consuming for your family when you're gone. So that first initial conversation, I basically just sit down and ask people a whole bunch of questions. And it's typically an hour, hour and a half where we'll just sit there and talk through things. And then I'll explain how estate planning works. And from there, I'll explain the various documents that we're going to possibly talk about and give mm-hmm. options that would make sense.
That's great. And people aren't thinking at that moment in time about exactly when they're going to pass away. I mean, it's just not.
Typically, we don't know.
That's a much easier conversation because it's kind of like you're forecasting, you're kind of projecting someday, oh, I'm going on that trip to Italy in a month. I really want to get this done. You know, either they have young kids or maybe they have children that are adults already. So what do you find, you know, when it comes to that? Like, how do people think about like their kids when they're planning?
It's funny you bring up the vacation aspect of it. I have so many people that will be like, I'm leaving on a trip. I really want to get this done. And they've, you know, mm-hmm. they're 40, 50, 60 years old and they've never had an estate plan. And all of a sudden we have a conversation and they're out in 2 weeks. We're like, can we get it done? And so all of a sudden it becomes part of this thing that's to your forefront. You know, once we have that conversation, mm-hmm. it tends to, I find a lot of people will say, when can we meet? Can we meet like, you know, in an hour? it suddenly becomes much more real, I think, when you've had the conversation about how this stuff should go.
I think it does. And when it comes to those people trying to identify who it is that they're going to want to list, what should they be thinking about? Like, and when I say list in the documents, I mean like either as a power of attorney, or maybe a trustee or just an estate administrator.
Yeah. So I think that probably to answer that, we need to talk a little bit about what these various documents are that, you know, just sure. in a very simple estate plan. There's lots of different types of estate plans and they can be very, very complex. But in the most basic of situations, if I'm meeting with, you know, a young kid that's 18 years old, I do that a lot where my clients will send their kids in after they turn 18 to get power of attorneys. So every single person over 18 needs to have an estate plan in the limited context of at minimum powers of attorney. So a healthcare power of attorney, somebody making medical decisions, or a durable power of attorney, somebody making financial decisions. So those are forms that are guardianship avoidance forms. We're mm-hmm. trying to avoid going through the court system. So, you know, you've raised these kids for 18 years and on their 18th birthday, suddenly you don't have the right to do things that you used to be able to do. So the conversation about who you're listing and what we're doing, I think we need to talk about mm-hmm. those various forms first and then kind of backtrack into who you're going to pick to do various, you know, yeah. aspects of your plan.
Doesn't necessarily have to be like the oldest child or the one that had the specific, maybe it does have someone who's got a specific background, maybe in healthcare or something.
Yep. So, very good point. So, you know, I give the example of my wife and I all the time where if it's a medical sort of a question, please don't list her. You know, she's yeah. much more knowledgeable on healthcare power of attorneys. If it's a financial document, it's not to say she's bad with money, but, you know, I deal with this stuff on a daily basis, so I'm going to be the better person. So really, I want people to think who's best at doing whatever the task will be. So in estate planning, we're talking about financial situations and we're talking about medical situations. Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking about the financial side, I want people to think who's the best person at handling money, who's got the time. So it's not necessarily this, you know, easy thing. It can be, you know, you're incapacitated for 15 years. That's a real burden yeah. on people as well. So think about who's the best, not necessarily who's the oldest. And then, you know, again, think financially and then think medically. And those do not have to align. More often than not, they don't.
Right. So many things that we're going to be talking about today. Like, I wish we could basically have, you know, hours to discuss it, but we really have a limited amount of time. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, want to talk a little bit about, you know, ways once you've kind of crafted that estate plan, what should people be thinking about in terms of beneficiary designations and things of that? So we'll be right back after this break.
Want to keep building wealth that aligns with your values? New episodes of Money Sense drop weekly. Subscribe now and continue learning how your money, your choices, and your life can work together.
Welcome back to Money Sense. We're here with Eric Fabian of Haight & Fabian law offices out of Heartland, Wisconsin. Thanks again for joining us today, having a good conversation about something that's not so happy to talk about, which is, you know, legacy end-of-life planning. I know that this is something that probably a lot of people, financial planners, you know, they're not really just focused on that. We do run into it all the time here, unfortunately, where we, because we've been here for 30 years and we've got clients that have been with us. We're now working with their children and their grandchildren. And it's really sad, but it does happen. We get a phone call, you know, and spouse passed away and they're letting us know that sad news, which, you know, we're going to cover a lot of that kind of mindset down the line. But before we get in to that, let's go back to talking about the beneficiary element and then those documents that support that. So, you know, again, going back to estate planning, first people think of a will, maybe they should be thinking about that and other things.
Yep. So the will is sort of the thing that everybody thinks about because that's what we've come to know from all the old movies and everything else, right? And so the will is a very important concept of an estate plan because we want to know where things are supposed to go, right? And so a will is, you know, very much a point in time document. Upon my death, here's where I want my assets to go. Here's who my beneficiaries are. And most of the time in this day and age, I tend to find we're looking to do probate avoidance for estate planning, meaning we don't want to go through the court system in order to move assets. And so what a will is it's a document that you're going to go through the court system, through the probate system to be able to administer it. And so in the will, we're going to open up a probate estate, which is a court case. And a lot of times mm-hmm. I want to avoid that for various reasons. So it's a lot more time consuming to go through the
court
system.
It's right?
Public information. So CCAP is great to look people up, but sometimes you want privacy. Yeah. So if you've passed away, you have a court case, your inventory, that's your date of death value of assets shows up online, your beneficiary information, so your kids' names, their addresses shows up online. So people look up the kids down the road and they can see that they came into X number of dollars, which, you know, if you're dating somebody, that becomes an interesting thing to know, right? So I try to avoid all of that. And also I try and pay the government as little as possible. And so the court system, it's $2 per thousand as a filing fee. So more often than not, in estate planning, we're looking to do probate avoidance, which is basically beneficiary designations or trusts.
Okay. Yeah. And the trust itself is such an important document because immediately when people, if they're not familiar, they think trust is extremely complicated. Like it's just in my mind, oh my gosh, this crazy thing that has this mystery behind it because it's a trust. In reality, I mean, there can be highly complex trusts, right?
For sure.
But for the vast majority of people working in a family situation, how complicated is it?
Yeah, so a lot of times people say, well, I'm not super rich, I don't need a trust. And, you know, they think, you know, if your last name isn't like Pabst or Miller, that you don't have enough assets. And that's really not the case. So there's lots of types of trusts. And the vast majority of people that I work with end up having trusts for a few different reasons. One, it makes things a lot easier. It expedites the process when you pass. There are simple ways to draft trusts where it doesn't have to be very complex or very costly. It avoids the probating of an estate. So in the most typical sense, if I'm talking to somebody, even somebody, let's, you know, this is, we were talking about beneficiaries. So let's just say that you've got a young family starting out. They're, you know, 26, 27 years old. They're in their first job and they haven't really built a nest egg
saving
yet.
Saving for a house.
Exactly.
Right.
But they've got this new baby on the way and, you know, they talk to the financial advisor and start talking about life insurance, which I'm sure you'll want to touch on in a bit. So now all of a sudden I've got somebody that maybe they don't have a lot of assets, but maybe they've got a $500,000 or $1 million life insurance policy. Well, a trust can be wonderful to have because I can fund that life insurance policy into a trust for the benefit of their child or their children. I can have people that they want in control of that kid's inheritance until whatever minimum age that they've dictated. So typically 30 is the most common age people pick, but anybody really over 25, I don't want an 18-year-old senior to come into money, right? So what we're trying to do is we're trying to put plans in place where if something happens to that, you know, young couple just starting out, that we've got a good, you know, plan for the next 25 to 30 years for that little kid that they're having.
Succession, right? That whole planning, that idea, it's so key. One thought that comes to mind with establishing a trust is that once you create it, how easy is it to change it? If it's just you created it, but you want to adjust it, how is that?
It's either extremely easy or darn near impossible. So, or somewhere in between. So, the most common type of a trust is a revocable trust. So, a revocable trust, by far the vast majority of people that you're going to meet are going to have a revocable versus an irrevocable trust. And a revocable trust has a lot of benefits. It's disregarded. It's your social security number. It's not separately taxed. You control it. You're managing your money. You do as you please with your money. But what happens is that when you pass away, your successor trustee, the person that you've dictated to be in charge, applies for an employer identification number with the IRS. And now this thing springs into existence as a business.
Right.
And so, you know, up until that point, it's revocable. If you want to change trustees, if you want to change beneficiaries, if you want to do whatever you want, it's very, very simple. The extent of the change will dictate whether I do an amendment, which is, you know, I'm going to change one paragraph to say something else, or maybe there's been a lot of amendments that becomes really confusing, so I could do a restatement, or if there's wholesale changes to the structure of the trust, I'll do a restatement, which is a new trust taking place of that old one, but keeping the same title so that they don't keep going back to you in other places and saying, hey, I need to update all of my accounts now. I don't want things to be harder. I want to make things easier for them.
Right. And you can really more or less direct, like you, the example of life insurance, you can put the trust as the beneficiary if it makes sense to do that, so that the trust itself becomes the document that delegates how those assets are to flow to beneficiaries, to children, maybe to fund a supplemental needs trust for someone who has a disability.
Exactly.
Protect those assets and things of that nature. So no, that's really key. And again, it's just a document at the end of the day, right? So let's move toward talking a little bit more about the powers of attorney. I know we were going to go through the rest of the documents in there. What does the power of attorney give someone? Let's talk about the durable, the financial power of attorney.
Sure.
When is it good for? How long does it last?
Yeah, so, I mean, technically they don't expire. That being said, the older they are, the more difficult they become to use. So I've had plenty of times where, you know, first of all, I guess we should talk about the purpose of that document, which is generally a durable power of attorney is used for appointing somebody to handle your finances if you can't. And it could be that you can't because you're out of town and you want somebody to do something. Or alternatively, it could be that you can't because you're incapacitated, right? And so a lot of times, or I shouldn't say a lot of times, but occasionally I've had somebody that's called me up and said, hey, the bank won't let me access, you know, mom and dad's account because they say this power of attorney is too old. And the whole point of this power of attorney was that when mom and dad were incapacitated, they wanted, you know, this person in charge. So what do we do? And so if you think about it from the bank's perspective, well, if this thing is, you know, 3-4 years old, yeah, it's probably the most recent document. Whereas if it's 25-30 years old, now they're looking at it and saying, I don't know.
1996.
Exactly. So I don't know if I want to have this person coming in and taking money out of this account, and maybe we're worried about our liability.
Right.
And so for durable power of attorneys, you know, I really say every 7 to 10 years, it's a good idea to update them just because of the nature of how they work. We can get around that in those situations that I have to work with the bank and draft attorney opinion letters. But of course I'm charging now for my time. And in the interim too, you know, we don't have access. And the whole point was to probably
to avoid it,
to make sure bills are getting paid on time. So,
critical document to have. I mean, one of the biggest considerations, I think, and you can speak to this, is if somebody should make their power of attorney immediate or if it should be based on like a springing action or something like that.
Yeah. So when I'm drafting a durable power of attorney, typically if it's a married couple, I'm going to make it effective immediately because they're married and why wouldn't you? If it's a single individual, then I typically in my form will give them an option. Do you want to make it effective immediately or do you want to have it spring into existence upon an incapacity? Right. You know, there's benefits and downsides, obviously, and it's not necessarily up for me to say, well, here's what makes sense for you. So you kind of have to explain the situation. Do you want somebody to be able to step in right away and handle finances even if you're fine? So there's a lot of trust that you're putting into whoever you're nominating, right? You're giving them the ability to access your accounts. So if you don't trust them, why are you nominated to begin with?
Yeah.
But other times people look at it and say, well, if I can do it, why should I appoint somebody else effective immediately?
Very case by case.
It is.
Yeah,
and,
very much
case by case. Unfortunately, there are situations where people don't think there's anything wrong with them. So if you're suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's, and well, good luck to go see the doctor in order to get the power of attorney to spring into activation. So there's, downsides sometimes
that's
to make it into springing power.
The mitigating, the mitigation of those situations, getting it done beforehand.
Yes.
That's where I think people, as they're going through their planning, they need to say, I'm just going to get this done and I don't need to really worry about it then at that point. Maybe they'll want to revisit, but it's done. And the vast majority of the plans that I've seen, come out, even if they're 10, 15, 20 years old, maybe the laws have changed or updated, but I mean, for the most part, the document will be good if it's done. I mean, how often do you recommend people revisit it?
Yeah. So the Uniform Trust Code was basically passed in the state of Wisconsin in 2014. And so our laws really changed a lot in 2014. Then there was the Trust Code trailer bill that came out a couple of years ago now. Yeah. So when you're looking at things that are pre-2014, it's a little outdated, but it's still valid. It's not to say that it's not. There's a lot more that you can do in estate planning now that wasn't really even an option back in, 2006.
Sure.
So, if you're looking at an older plan, it's probably time to at least
something
meet with
maybe
an attorney.
10, 15 years or more.
Yeah,
it's a good time to visit.
Yeah. And then, people are often telling me, I just did that, 5 years ago, and then you pull it out and it's 15 years ago. So estate planning, you kind of don't love thinking about it.
Or they pull out what they think is a trust and it's a will.
Or they'll say, I have a will,
and then
they have a trust, which
is
probably more common, to be honest with you.
So that's why I think, kind of taking it back to the approach that we like to deliver is just a team. We want to make sure that this isn't something that you're doing, putting it on the shelf, dusting it off when somebody, either when there's an issue, one, or just because someone asked you, right? And so that's a critical thing. Now, we are talking about end-of-life planning and conversations that matter, which I think is key. It's a great topic. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, Eric and I are going to dive into some other thoughts around this. We'll be right back.
It's tax season, and here's something you might not know. Ellenbecker Investment Group is home to a dedicated team of tax professionals who partner directly with our wealth advisors to support your full financial picture. We believe smart tax planning is an essential part of building true financial well-being. If you're ready for a more connected, more confident tax experience, head to ellenbecker.com. You deserve exceptional. You deserve EIG.
All right, we're back with Eric Fabian, Hayton Fabian, estate planning attorney, and someone that I reach out to when I, obviously need some guidance in certain areas, things come up. Eric, you've been involved in a number of family situations where people have lost loved ones.
Oh, yes.
And it's not fun. Right. I mean, even personally, like dealing with it in our own families. I started to talk about earlier when we get a phone call, from somebody, I lost a family member, my spouse died, I really want to make sure I get things done properly. It takes me back to what I mentioned earlier around when we meet with our clients for the first time, and this goes all the way back to how Karen and Julie founded our company, is we don't just want people to come in and say, here, manage all these investments. We want to make sure it's done right. We want to make sure that we've talked through it and we have an understanding of what is expected, right, for them, how they want to live their legacy. So we bring you in those first couple of meetings. And I think the idea is we're doing it so that we can build a framework and also set up their portfolios, their investments on top of that framework or foundation, I refer to it as. So why don't we just kind of talk a little bit about that? We've gone through, the estate plan is done. We've picked those that we think are going to be the right people. There's also, you don't just stop at one, you pick, who, if they're not able to, then who's next and then who's next. And then maybe they have other assets too that they want to make sure that get passed on to people. Like, for example, I remember one time we had a conversation. Then after the attorney left the room, we found out they had a gun, like a gun collection, or they had a coin collection or baseball cards or something like that. What do you think? What comes to mind there for you?
Yeah. So first of all, I Ellen Becker, throughout the time that I've worked with you guys, it's always been a really important component of, I think, how you're meeting with clients is to ensure that you fully explain how the whole financial picture works, right? And estate mm-hmm. planning is a part of that. And so, you know, I typically get brought in early on simply to make sure that the accounts get structured according to what the client is looking for, right? So right. Some of your clients, I'm sure, just have their names on an account and that's it. But a lot of them probably have beneficiaries listed, and it could be, you know, individuals, or oftentimes a trust is listed as a beneficiary, or it could be an asset protection trust for the benefit of people. So differences outright distribution to people versus maybe we want to put protections in place for the benefit of the kids' creditors, or to make sure that they don't get subject to division and divorce through inheritance. And then with respect to, you know, things like the coin collection or you know, firearms, et cetera, firearms are kind of a unique one. You know, in Wisconsin, I think the vast majority of people that I meet are, you know, if they have a gun collection, it's typically, you know, the hunter with, you know, the 12-gauge shotgun kind of a thing. It's not like the silencer or suppressor type, you know, things that we have to be
it's
a little more concerned with.
It's the heritage,
with.
You know, the heritage type things.
Exactly. Know? So, I mean, there's things like gun trusts, which are very unique and, you know, geared more towards maintaining things that maybe have classified characteristics, or, you know, to ensure that we don't have a beneficiary that can't have a gun that comes into possession of a gun through estate planning. So all that is why it's really unique, and to have those full conversations with people. And it's amazing sometimes when you start asking a couple questions and then they start talking, and all of a sudden things are completely different than what you're probably initially thinking.
Yeah. And legacy. And the one that comes to mind is family property. Like if there's a place up north, there's acreage, there might be a house, you know, that right there specifically is definitely a reason to plan.
Yeah. Planning for the family vacation property when, you know, that's probably one of the more complex conversations that I have. And on that, I typically, you know, if I'm meeting with the parent generation first, and having a conversation about the up north property, and then I tell them, and this kind of goes towards what you titled this was Conversations That Matter. I think it's really important to bring in the adult children in that situation, not just to sit there talking to the parents who dictate what happens, because, you know, if you've got three or four kids that now each come into this property and have to manage it and use it, and how do we handle payment of expenses, all that is so important. So I think conversations between family members and estate planning is such an important and overlooked thing. You know, I think that if you view it from the perspective of, you know, people years ago, I think they didn't like to talk about money amongst family members or to talk about estate planning. And I think there's a lot of value once your kids are older to have those conversations with them.
I'm so glad that you hit on that, because I had that as an item I wanted to discuss today. And so, you know, we'll come back to that in a minute, but I do want to talk about the beneficiary designation. So, you know, you think about all the things you have. Obviously, you've got, you know, everything in your house, chattel, whatever, the dishes. Karen Ellenbeck always talks about like the special set of china that the sisters all thought was going to be theirs, you know, but that turns out that the other sister ended up with it.
Or what you find out is oftentimes that was like the really, you know, grandparents' china, everybody you know, thought was going to be some valuable, important thing. And now you can go to the pawn shop and see lots of people's stuff because nobody wants their parents' stuff anymore.
Nobody wants it. The antiques weren't what they used to be. But then there's like that heartfelt, you know, thing about like what it means with the sentimental value, which is key. So
those have been some of the worst cases I've been involved with, were non-valuable things that had importance to the children and arguing over something that nobody else in the world would care about. That's where, you know, you can appoint, you can say, you know, within a trust, for instance, or within a will, you can always identify personal property going to a particular person. And so sometimes that's a good way of, you know, trying to avoid fights amongst your kids in the future.
Yeah, I think that's key for people to sit down after they've done their estate plan and take your guidance, because you give people a page to fill that out. So that's key. Let's talk about some of the more kind of common things. You know, one thing that we do when we meet with our clients regularly is we do a beneficiary designation review with them to make sure not only do we have the most recent up-to-date documents, your office and the other attorneys we work with are really good about making sure like things are updated. We met with them and we did an amendment or whatnot, but also just checking it to make sure, hey, you know, we've got the designation between per capita and per stirpes. Talk about that for a minute, because that is such an important estate planning idea.
Right. It's such a thing that most people don't even know what these Latin phrases mean when they're checking the box on like an insurance policy when they take it out, for instance. So it's really good to have a conversation with somebody actually knows what those phrases mean, or if you don't have a conversation, look them up. But yeah, do you want the assets to, if you have a child that predeceases you, do you want them to flow down that child's bloodline? So a per stirpes designation where it's going to flow down that way, or per capita designation? Do we want something where we're going to treat all of a particular generation the same? So if two kids predecease out of three, then rather than splitting the shares into thirds, maybe we have the generation of grandkids receiving yep. all the same. There's not a right or wrong answer. That's why you have to ask the questions.
Well, it's so key, because not many people understand what that means, and what if you check the box, right? Like it's either, you know, if the child predeceases, their share will go to the remaining three children if they have four kids, or their share would go down to the grandchildren. And yeah. that's just such a recently had something like that happen. And it was these grandkids were, you know, in a position where, you know, they were going to receive some inheritance as part of that by design, not by default. So
yeah, so I always tell people, whenever I've met with them, you know, I want to know what type of assets they're holding, and I want them to check to see what their current beneficiary designation structure is. You know, and then from there, oftentimes we'll modify that, because yep. you know, if I'm creating a trust, for instance, then oftentimes if there's a benefit to creating the trust as the beneficiary of an account, or an asset protection trust for the benefit of kids as the account. So a lot of times it will be changed, but you want to make sure that you know what the beneficiary designation says, because they really do trump everything. So mm-hmm. if a beneficiary designation says it goes to, you know, John Smith, and in the meantime you've created a trust and the trust has, you know, benefits for, you know, three different kids, well, the trust is irrelevant in that situation. So we want to make sure we're funding everything correctly.
Absolutely. And we're already up against a break. And when we get back, we're going to cover a few other great concepts and wrap it up. So you've been listening to Money Sense.
Ellenbecker Investment Group is officially launching our brand new program, The Wealth Seed. This program is designed to give you high-quality financial guidance tailored to your stage of saving, no matter your experience level. As part of this program, you'll get a growing library of short, easy-to-understand financial podcasts, monthly educational emails, interactive workshops, and curated tools like book and media recommendations. Plant your wealth seed today and start growing with us at ellenbecker.com/thewealthseed.
Welcome back to Money Sense. We're here with Eric Fabian. So before the break, we were talking about a lot of concepts related to estate planning. But one thing I did want to just ask you, like, what are the first things that people think about when they're tasked with helping someone settle their estate? Or if they're, you know, now we're in a place where mom or dad has passed away, or maybe both, you know, have passed within a relative period of time. They've got a lot going through their mind. What was there anything that comes to mind for you that would kind of set them at ease?
Yeah, so I guess we'll step back 1 second from that and talk about the preparation of the documents first, and then mm-hmm. move forward to that.
Sure.
So in every estate plan that I draft, I always provide a funeral instructions form.
Okay.
And it's something that people really haven't given much thought to. And I always tell them, you know, fill this thing out. Give some thought as to who you'd want, you know, in charge, who's secondary, you know, backup person, you know, what type of planning do you want? What, you know, do you want a big party for friends? Do you want a religious ceremony? All that kind of stuff you can put in there. And that form is, it's put out by the state of Wisconsin, and I always tell people, you know, it says on there, whoever you've designated should sign it. I think that's really important because it probably means that you've had a conversation with them and that they've seen that form. So it's more likely that they'll know it exists, because what happens when somebody dies, especially if it's a sudden death, typically, you know, people leaving estate planning and signing with me, they're going to have a large binder full of estate planning documents. And if somebody passes away suddenly, the thing that happens typically first is calling the funeral home. It's not, hey, let's read through this whole binder of legal documents, you know. So if they don't know that document is in there, and probably not going to follow it. So,
and I think that ties back to something we referenced earlier around the family meetings that should happen. And I can just share, you know, that we have in the walls of EIG, we have dozens of those types of meetings every year with our clients and their children. And it doesn't have to be a full reveal of every detail, like how much money do mom and dad have? I mean, they can kind of say, here, this is a forum. You've got an unbiased third party in the room that could be the advisor, that could be someone, you know, just a professional, someone like yourself. And we could talk about what's expected around these things, like what's the first thing that's going to happen? Well, mom and dad are going to need, you know, dad passed away, we're going to need $20,000 or $15,000 for the funeral. Where do we get that money? Because a lot of times, if it's not done properly, I've seen where there hasn't been liquidity available in the estate. And I wanted to touch on that for a second. Do you have any initial thoughts on just that concept alone?
Yeah, so there's different ways of handling probate avoidance. And as I said, one of them is payable on death designation planning. And I've actually seen that done too well before, where all of the money was designated to go out to the various kids. And maybe the one kid didn't get along with the other kids, and good luck trying to claw some money back to pay for the funeral expenses, right? So having these conversations up front as to how we're going to pay for things is really important. And also having the conversations to say, hey, you're in charge. If ever I'm incapacitated or upon my death, here's where my forms are, and you're the point person, and you're number two. And, you know, to have knowledge as to what's happening, because there's certainly been times where people go in blindly and they say, I have no idea what's happening, trying to figure out where accounts are located. So I know that various advisors that I've worked with here at Ellenbecker say, you know, our card's right here in this binder, and, you know, if something happens, you know, tell your kids, you know,
give us a call
and we'll guide them through the process.
Yeah. And because we didn't talk about taxes yet, you know, there's so many things that need to be considered when people, when they're planning, you know, have to understand who's going to do the taxes. Like, is there a trust? Is there things that need to be looked at from the standpoint of cost basis and, you know, things that can get overlooked.
Taxes are another huge one. And it's one of the very common early questions that I get from somebody is, am I going to get taxed on this? Mm-hmm. And my answer is, it depends on the
depends.
Type of assets.
Really
so,
does.
Retirement accounts, you're probably going to have income with respect to the decedent. You'll probably get taxed on those. Other types of assets, so just a brokerage account, well, you get a stepped up basis to fair market value. So there's some benefits.
Some planning things there.
So how planning techniques, working with your financial advisor, and how we structure those accounts, well, that all comes into play.
One thing that I do like to mention in this context is that if people have done everything that they feel is right, and it's been validated through some of the planning meetings, right? And they're just saying, hey, look, what can I do? One thing that comes to mind, well, not only is life insurance in general an important planning tool, sometimes people have insurance in place, but there's a specific type of insurance that works well for this, and it's like a funeral policy. And if you're not familiar, it's worth exploring, because for a sum of money anywhere between typically $5,000 and maybe on the high side $20,000 to $25,000, average probably between $10,000 and $15,000 is what I've seen, is where somebody can work with an insurance company that provides a very specific type of insurance policy that the person, you know, the one that's named, the administrator or the trustee, you know, can talk to the funeral director or funeral provider and say, here, I've got this policy. You're familiar, Eric. So what does that typically cover?
When you're looking to do that, you're basically trying to pre-plan to make things a little bit easier for your kids for liquidity purposes, which you brought up earlier. So sometimes it takes a little bit to get access to money for various reasons. And so the idea of the insurance to cover the funeral is that that's one less headache that you're putting your family through when they're going through this, you know, traumatic life event as it is.
It takes a little bit of the pressure off of people to scramble because, you know, it's tough. If things aren't set up where there's liquidity available for these things, it can create some challenges. So that's one way. Another way is just to make sure that, you know, not only do they have their assets titled a certain way. I mean, nobody's going to think that, oh my gosh, the only thing that they have is access to the real estate. I mean, think about what would be involved if they had to sell the house to pay for things. But if they set up bank accounts the right way, then it should be pretty straightforward. So, you know, and again, it's going to be very unique for each individual. But if mom and dad or, you know, whoever we're planning for have a checking account, there could be some things that can be done from setting up designations on there to help provide liquidity. In a short order, it might not be that day, but it might be a few steps, right?
Yeah, typically. So first of all, I think that every bank account should have a beneficiary designation on it. And unless you're talking about like an LLC or something like that, but from an individual bank account perspective, every bank account should have a beneficiary designation listing somebody or an entity, meaning you could list, you know, your kids, or you could list a trust. And I guess that oversimplifies it because there's a few times where maybe you don't want to have a beneficiary designation. But the idea of it is that as soon as you get that death certificate, the whoever you've appointed as your trustee can go and close that account. Or if it's the kids, they can go and close that account and then fund it directly into, you know, the kids in equal shares or whatever you've dictated
right,
through
then
the
beneficiary follow the order of the plan. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Good, very good points. And again, it's the last thing a family member that's responsible for kind of delegating should find out is that they walk in the bank and there is nothing. It's just, we call it like sole ownership or a fee simple type of arrangement where that could create problems, right?
It can. And, you know, so when we talk about trusts, we talk about funding of a trust, for instance, and every once in a while, particularly more likely with single individuals, you know, if I've created an estate plan and we've done everything and they were supposed to go and put a beneficiary designation on the account and they didn't, then in Wisconsin, if you have over $50,000 cumulatively, well, we have to go through the probate system. And so now all
that
of a sudden...
That could be a classic car.
Yep. So
it could be, you know, a lot of things that if it's not done properly... could really tie into that, right?
Correct. And so whereas if the bank designation said, you know, the trust is the beneficiary, okay, we go in, we close it out with a death certificate. Now I'm open up a probate estate and I'm spending the next year dealing with that just because of the improper funding of the trust.
And terminology-wise, bank accounts on that side of the fence are POD, payable on death. Brokerage accounts at custodians like the one we use or the vast majority where you hold investments is TOD, right? Transfer on death.
Yep. So basically, I think the difference probably comes down to one is cash, so it's payable, and the other is transferable because it's some physical
securities.
Thing. So same with real estate. Real estate, you can have a transfer on death designation on real estate, and I use those quite frequently. I don't love them for transferring to multiple individuals because
sure.
I don't love transferring real estate to multiple people because of all the problems with co-ownership. But there are lots of times where I do use them, including funding of a trust.
So that's great insight. And then you can list the POD or TOD as perhaps maybe the trust, right? And
correct.
Then that'll give people the flexibility to write checks and settle the affairs, pay bills.
Yep, and it puts a point person in charge. So if you've got, you know, one person that's in charge of things after you're gone and you've got three kids that are inheriting, it's a lot easier typically to have the one person in charge, pay the funeral expenses, mm-hmm. wrap everything up, and then, you know, sell the real estate or distribute it out to somebody and then be done with it versus having three people that all basically have to work together on every little item.
Yeah, and so on that end, I mean, we could continue, you know, talking about those assets and things for a long time, but high level, I think that's great. A couple other final thoughts before we wrap up today's session. I just want to share one thing we haven't even touch the surface on is the from a legacy side, you know, intellectual property, maybe the family owns a business. I mean, that's a whole special area. But then let's talk just about just things that are in front of us, like our accounts, like our email, our Facebook account, or like our social media platforms or whatever it might be. You know, and again, those are really important things for people to plan for. So I encourage people to think about, there's a new feature that the phones now allow is to add a legacy contact in your phone. Upon preparation for today's show, I actually added my wife as a legacy contact.
I should probably do that.
Yeah. And it gives that person the authority to unlock your phone, get into things like that, that would be important in there. I mean, you could have banking, you could have, you know, any of your contacts, primarily contacts, but then as far as passwords, I mean, this is just very, the first thing they tell you, especially when you work in an industry like ours, is don't write it down. Try to remember your password. So obviously we've got things that now allow for us to have specialized encrypted security password, you know, keepers and things like that. But I would encourage people to be thoughtful about where you store your passwords, making sure that whomever it is that you've named has access, because there could be a large amount of information that would be challenged to access if we didn't have that information available.
It is so hard in certain circumstances to try and figure out how to, even what people have.
It's near impossible.
So, you know, you look at tax returns to see where they were generating an income, for instance, but that is such a small component of the overall, and trying to gain access to the most simplistic of things sometimes is problematic without the ability to access the email for account recovery. So yeah. I think that's an extraordinarily important thing, especially in this day and age where a lot of times we like to get the digital copies of something. And so it used to be, well, every month we'd get the mail. And so we'd say, well, here's the statement or this whatever. And now you can't even
see that.
People
aren't getting those anymore.
It's really hard sometimes.
I'm with you. And so that creates just kind of like, I think it takes us fully back to having those conversations that matter with those involved. It's not something you need to bring up at every meeting or every time you get together, but just having a very specific time, not only with the financial advisor to talk about certain things, because the advisors may not want to have that level of detail or shouldn't possibly be involved to that level with the family, but making sure that those loved ones that you have identified know what to do when the time comes. And that creates, in my view, a lot of peace of mind. It's going to probably avoid some, you know, waking up in the middle of the night type things if there's a lot going on, especially when, I hate to say it, but when people get sick or things happen, it's not always expected. It doesn't always happen in an orderly way because other things get in the way. So if you can be thoughtful and mindful about how you want to approach that, talk to your advisors, reach out to whoever you look to for those things. I would start with a review of your estate plan, and then obviously create an inventory of sorts, and then make sure that you work with your advisor to know where those documents can be found. If, you know, somebody comes forward, we obviously don't keep that information, but we have a lot of clients that will tell their kids, here's where I keep these documents in the house, you know, so that at that point, even like a safe deposit box key. Like, what is this key? What does this do? So those are some very important things. And again, Eric, I really appreciate your involvement today. Great information. We'll probably have you back, talk about this again sometime. So
thanks for having me. Appreciate
it. Absolutely. So you've been listening to Money Sense. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please reach out to Ellen Becker. We could be reached at ellenbecker.com or our phone number 262-691-3200. We've hoped that we've made a difference in your financial lives and well-being. Before we plan, before we act, we always listen. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Money Sense, brought to you by Ellen Becker Investment Group. If you found today's conversation helpful, we encourage you to share it with a friend or family member, and be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. At Ellen Becker Investment Group, we believe that education is the foundation of confident financial decisions. That's why we're proud to bring you insights from experienced professionals to help you build true wealth beyond just money. Please note, this podcast is intended for general informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized financial advice. Before making any financial decisions, we recommend consulting with a qualified advisor who understands your unique situation. For more resources, visit ellenbecker.com. We'll be back soon with more insights to help you live with clarity and confidence.